Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and this is The World in Words, number 40. Today, we have an action-packed edition of Global Linguistic Encounters, Obama and the Muslim World, American dairy farmers in Mexico, and John Updike in Africa. Also, Benicio del Toro conquers Latin America, one dialect at a time.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here. They all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is, merci beaucoup.
Jak się masz?
Borat, have you had enough of this podcast yet?
Jak się masz?
I guess not. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The big show is broadcast on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. Listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out our other podcasts. So today, some reaction from the Muslim world to President Obama's linguistic olive branch. Also, U.S. dairy farmers learn Spanish and much, much more in Mexico. Then actor Benicio del Toro on the many Spanishes of Che Guevara, who del Toro plays in the recently released biopic. And a tribute to the late John Updike's literary foray into French West Africa, in which he discovered an obsession with the French language. First, Barack Obama's dance with Muslims. Last week, the president gave an interview to TV station Al Arabiya, which is seen in most of the Arab-speaking world, when he was asked about how he would refer to what President Bush had called the war on terror. Obama said, the language we use matters. At another point in the interview, he said this.
My job is to communicate the fact that the United States has a stake in the well-being of the Muslim world, that the language we use has to be language of respect. You know, I have Muslim members of my family. I have lived in Muslim countries.
The largest one?
The largest one, Indonesia. And so what I want to communicate is the fact that in all my travels throughout the Muslim world, what I've come to understand is that regardless of your faith, and America is a country of Muslim, Jews, Christians, non-believers, regardless of your faith, people all have certain common hopes and common dreams.
Well, most of this went down pretty well in the Muslim world, among political leaders and also ordinary citizens. Here is Sharif Nashashibi. He is chairman of the London-based Arab Media Watch.
He kept reiterating the message that he is ready for a new relationship of listening, of mutual respect. I mean, he was consistently addressing the Muslim world and telling them that he is open to dialogue, particularly, you know, coming from the Bush era where George Bush was known and ridiculed for his controversial use of language. You have a president now who acknowledges that language is very important, particularly when addressing the Muslim world, where, you know, George Bush, for instance, would talk of a crusade and war on terror and things like that. You know, you have Obama talking about respect and saying how you can't tar an entire faith with the actions of a few people who claim to act on that faith.
Sharif Nashashibi, he heads up the London-based Arab Media Watch. Interestingly, the most negative response to Obama's interview and his previous speeches regarding the Muslim world came from a non-Arab Muslim leader, the Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He demanded an apology for America's, quote, crimes against Iran. Now, we're going to take a trip to a little visited corner of rural Mexico, along with a group of American dairy farmers. The reason they're going is because the workers that these farmers employ, and of course many of them are undocumented, these workers are from this part of Mexico. The tours have been taking place for several years now. As you'll hear from our guide, the big show's Katie Clark, they began as language learning vacations, but along the way, they've become something a little bit more than that.
Dairy farmer Mark Johnson is from Rushford, Minnesota, population 2,300. He'd heard about the trips to Mexico and was eager to come. 10 of Johnson's 18 employees are Mexican migrants. The majority of them come from a village in central Mexico called Tlaquilpa. We're headed there now.
It seems like we've been traveling forever. Do you find it kind of hard to believe that people have come from here to your
home? Most definitely.
We arrive in Tlaquilpa, a small community perched on a mountain ridge. The family we're visiting lives in a simple cement house. This is the home of one of Mark Johnson's employees. The family has prepared a meal for us of bread and stew. We wash it down with a sweet punch. Shortly after we arrive, more people begin streaming in. They've walked an hour and a half to meet us. Everyone here seems to have a husband, son, or father who works on Johnson's farm. There are lots of quiet moments during our afternoon in Tlaquilpa. Most of the Americans only know a few words of Spanish and even less of the indigenous language many of the people here speak, and the Mexicans don't understand much English. Still, everyone seems to enjoy the visit. Before leaving, Mark Johnson gives a toast.
I want to thank everyone for putting on this big feast for us.
Dice, les da las gracias a todos por venir y por, para preparar la
comida. And I want to tell everyone that I am so pleased to have your sons and husbands working for us.
Dice que es con mucho orgullo que es el patrón de sus hijos, sus esposos, sus papás.
And that you would take time out of your day to come and see me.
The families then offer their own blessing.
Igual, dígale usted que igualmente nos da mucho gusto que nos acompañen en visita. Es un gran placer para nosotros.
Y que gracias porque nos da trabajo.
That you are here.
¿Mandé?
Y gracias también porque les da trabajo a nuestros hijos.
And thank you for giving work to their sons.
Y conviene
muchas gracias también.
And for being friends with them at home too.
Porque los quieren, ¿verdad? Los quieren.
Because they love you.
The woman translating there is Sean Duval. Duval organized this trip to Mexico as part of a program she began in the late 1990s called Puentes/Bridges. She says that in each of the 8 years she's brought American farmers to Mexico, there's always at least one moment that brings tears to her eyes. Duval says it's obvious that the Americans get a lot out of these visits, and she says the Mexican families also benefit.
These families here send their dear ones up there, and they have no idea where they're going to end up. You know, they might know, well, he's going to Wisconsin, but they don't have a clue where Walmondy, Wisconsin is, or Rushford, Minnesota, you know. And so to have that producer come down, and then they get to see him and shake his or her hand. I'm sure if you had your daughter that you sent her to Siberia and you had no idea where she was going. Somebody from Siberia who was working with her came here and
met her.
With photos and pictures and gifts from them. I think that would mean a lot, wouldn't it? I mean, it would for me.
Duval is a former Spanish teacher from Alma, Wisconsin. She started Puentes after being asked to interpret for local dairy farmers and their Mexican employees. The annual trips to Mexico were an extension of that work. The trips last almost 2 weeks. Typically, they cost around $2,000 per person. Duval says the trips were initially conceived as a crash course in the languages and culture of Mexico. It was the dairy farmers themselves, she says, who came up with the idea of visiting the homes of their employees.
Because they work side by side with these employees, and because in rural areas you know everybody that works for you, and you know their families, and you know their history. So it just makes sense that you would want to know about the guys who are working for you, even though they live thousands of miles away, or their families do.
For Nora Lindstrom, coming on this trip is even more personal. Lindstrom helps run her family farm in Durand, Wisconsin. Her live-in boyfriend, Guillermo, is from one of the villages we're also going to visit.
I've been dating Guillermo for, gosh, almost 4 years. So, yeah, I'll be visiting his mom.
Like many of the Mexican farm workers, Guillermo is in the U.S. illegally. He hasn't visited his home country for more than 4 years. His mom lives in a remote community called Suchiles. 5 of her 6 children have at various times gone north to seek jobs in the United States. The only work locally is at a sugarcane plant. But there are more people than jobs, and the plant only pays $10 a day. Lindstrom's visited Guillermo's mom once before. Still, she says it's hard to prepare for the stark differences between life in rural Mexico and life in Wisconsin.
Last year, I stayed with his family, and I took the first shower ever without running water in my entire life. Like, to have warm water, they boiled it for me, and I bawled the whole time.
Lindstrom bawled because she knew that while Guillermo's mother was happy to see her, the elderly woman longed to see her son again. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. Sneaking across the border has gotten a lot harder since Guillermo first came to the United States almost a decade ago. That's thanks in part to beefed up patrols along the border. It's also due to the fact that crossing the border with professional smugglers is now more expensive and dangerous. Compared to what Guillermo would have to go through to return home, Lindstrom says her journey here has been easy. Well, relatively speaking. We've been driving for around 5 hours, and there's still no village in sight. When we finally pull up to Guillermo's mother's house, Lindstrom is greeted as if she were a member of the family.
How are you?
You want some oranges? This place is famous for oranges, so you should try some.
The visit lasts several hours. Lindstrom brings gifts from Guillermo and photos from Wisconsin. Guillermo's mother smiles at how much heavier her son appears to have grown.
Guillermo? No tanto.
Guillermo is bigger than he used to be?
Uh-huh.
Or no? Yeah?
See? He eats well.
The goodbyes come all too soon. Later, Lindstrom says the long trip was well worth it. I ask her at one point who she thinks benefits more from this relationship, the American farmers who employ Mexican workers or the Mexicans themselves.
They're helping us, but at the same time, we're helping them. It's equal almost. You know what I mean? We need the people to do the work, and they want to work because they want a better life for their family here.
One of the more rewarding parts of this trip for the American farmers was seeing what the wages they pay go toward. There were new washing machines, TVs, and stereos. There were also new homes and businesses they all hoped would last a lifetime. For The World, this is Katie Clark, Suchiles, Mexico.
Okay, we're going to stay in Latin America now. We're going to test out a few regional dialects of Spanish with actor Benicio del Toro. Del Toro's latest film is Che, that's Che Guevara, whom he plays. It's a biopic. Ernesto Che Guevara was born and raised in Argentina. He trained as a doctor. He toured South America on a motorcycle. There's a movie about that, of course, based on the diaries that he kept. He volunteered at a leper colony in Peru, and then he got involved in social reform movements and revolutions in several Latin American countries. And that is where the dialects come in. Che got used to speaking in a variety of different dialects. Here he is, or rather, here is Benicio del Toro, talking with an illiterate Cuban man who's just joined the communist guerrillas there.
Che, Joel. Fidel me preguntó que por qué no te había hecho teniente. Y le dije que no podía porque tú aún no sabías leer ni escribir.
Bueno, yo lo quiero aprender, pero necesito que alguien me enseñe.
Entonces busco un lápiz y un par de libretas. Ponlos en tu mochila.
Now, my Spanish is fairly rudimentary, so someone, you maybe, is going to have to tell me how Argentine middle-class Che Guevara sounds here as he's talking in the Cuban jungle. It's also worth bearing in mind that Benicio del Toro is from Puerto Rico. So you have a Puerto Rican actor playing an Argentine who's hanging out with Cubans. Anyway, The Big Show's Lisa Mullen spent some time recently with Benicio del Toro. Del Toro told her that he got some help with his accent from a couple of Che's relatives.
His son, Pablo Guevara, then helped me with the accent, the Argentine, pseudo-Argentine accent that Che had.
Can you give us an example, by the way, Benicio, of what might sound, a word that might sound different if you're in Puerto Rico or Argentina?
Well, the Argentine letter D is up in the palate, in the front of the palate. Like, it's out here, and the tongue almost touches the teeth. In Caribbean, like Cuban and Puerto Rico, it's like a that. It has a clapping sound. So those had to be toned down. And you can imagine I had a Guevara telling me to tone it down. And so it was kind of like sometimes kind of like you wanted to pull his head apart. But he helped me a lot, too, working on the accent. So it's kind of interesting how that goes. So Che's nephew was helping me day in, day out with the accent. And Che had a very particular accent because he had lived for a long time in Guatemala. He had lived for a long time, and I'm talking a long time, maybe a year, another year and a half in Mexico. He's surrounded by Cubans. He goes to Cuba, but he doesn't go to Cuba, to Havana, where he could be understood clearly, but he goes to where the peasants are.
The very opposite end of Cuba.
And so he's surrounded by Cubans, and he's surrounded by a Spanish that is like even more Cuban than anything he's encountered. And he had to make a huge conscious effort to be understood. So his Argentine accent, he really had to get rid of it, you know, as much as he could.
Yeah,
he never got rid of it completely. You can hear things, rhythms that are Argentine in his Cuban, Mexican speech, you know. So it's interesting. He also was in a part of Cuba where the accent there, it's similar to the Dominican Republic and to Puerto Rico.
Can I ask you something else there? This is your first film that you've done in Spanish?
This is the first film that I do, a full film in Spanish, yeah.
How come you decided that?
It wasn't my decision. It was Steven's...
Steven Soderbergh.
Steven Soderbergh, the director. It was his decision. He called me one day, and because this movie at the beginning was going to be done in English. I always felt like it should have been done in Spanish too, you know, silently. But we were writing in English, and so. But at some point, Steven said it had to be done in Spanish.
Did that make it easier or harder for you?
Harder. Makes it harder because every movie I've done is in English.
But you're, I assume, still fluent in Spanish.
I'm fluent in Spanish. Even if you're fluent in Spanish, it's complicated. I don't know if there's a term for it, but it becomes difficult. Number one, my Spanish is Puerto Rican. My Spanish is not as eloquent or, you know, scholarly as Che's Spanish. You know, that UN speech is basically Cervantes Spanish. It's Shakespeare Spanish. You know, had I not had the manuscript of that speech, it would be difficult for me to write something like that. And it's really interesting. One more thing that I'd like to say is, like, how to listen in Spanish. One thing is to say the word and say the line, but the other thing is to listen in Spanish. There's an art of listening in movies. It's like it's, you know, you have to listen to what the other person is saying. So you have to, one say is to say, to talk in Spanish, but then the other thing is to actually listen to the Spanish coming in. I've been doing movies in English, so I got my way of listening in English, you know.
You mentioned the speech that Che gave in 1964 before the United Nations. Let's hear a little bit of that now.
Y su marcha de gigantes ya no se detendrá hasta conquistar la verdadera independencia por la que ya han muerto más de una vez inútilmente.
So that's the real Che Guevara at the UN. Now, here is Benicio del Toro playing Che Guevara at the UN. Bear in mind that this isn't the same bit of the speech and that the audio quality, of course, is completely different.
Señor presidente, señores delegados, muchos han avanzado en el mundo en este campo, pero el imperialismo, norteamericano sobre todo, ha pretendido hacer creer que la coexistencia pacífica es de uso exclusivo de las grandes potencias de la Tierra.
Now, back briefly to Benicio del Toro and the Big Show's Lisa Mullins.
You know, when you watch the film, this is one of the few times when you see Che as a revolutionary in the kind of image that we might expect, someone who is extremely passionate, not in the kind of tempered way that you see in the rest of the film. I mean, this is a man who I think you play with great subtlety. He's a man who is seems to be very fair, seems to be extremely sensible, who wants when his fellow revolutionaries steal a car, wants them to bring the car back once they've finished using it. How did you decide to interpret this, as you say, very kind of elegant Spanish with this passion before the United Nations? Because this is the time when you see, I think anyway, a very different Che. What was going through your head as you did this?
I think to me, and if we were going to dissect the movie, that black and white section of the movie when he was in New York City for 10 days, that's kind of like the interior monologue of the character. That's what he believes in. And he's just saying it to the audience. As a viewer, and you're putting together this character from the sections of his life that we pick to show, that section becomes what he stands for, verbalized.
And speaking of verbalizations, Benicio del Toro has provided us with this week's Eating Sideways segment. That is a word or a phrase in a foreign language that defies easy translation into English. So here goes.
Te cogieron de mango bajito. te cogieron de mango bajito, which means, this is Puerto Rican Spanish, which means they took advantage of you. You became mango that hangs very low, so it's, they fooled you very easily.
The imagery is turning you into a mango that hangs low, so it's easily picked on or eaten. Yeah, so te cogieron de mango bajito.
Okay, now for our final item, which concerns John Updike. He died late last month. I've read a couple of Updike novels, also some short stories. But I'd never even heard of a novel that he wrote in the 1970s called The Coup, as in C-O-U-P. It's the only novel that he wrote that's set in Africa, and he got mixed reviews for it. Here he is talking about those reviews in a 1984 CBS radio interview.
I remember People magazine, not the ultimate critical authority, but a formidable presence on the newsstand, said that Dickens didn't write about Arizona and Updike shouldn't be writing about Africa.
Doesn't it sound like he almost enjoyed that criticism? It is a pretty lame point when you come to think of it, that writers should limit themselves geographically. Anyway, in the same interview, Updike said he did his on-the-ground research for The Coup in fairly short order.
Perhaps a total of, if you count Egypt and Morocco as part of Africa, I may have spent as about a total of 6 weeks on the continent. And I had read a lot of African novels, and I was trying to write one more African novel. Most of my research was done in books. I'd never been to that specific part of Africa. It is the Sahel, sort of sub-Saharan dry countries like Mali, Chad, and Niger, that my fictional Kush is more or less based on.
The World's Marco Werman is a big fan of this particular novel, The Coup. Marco, why is that?
I got to say, I'm not an Updike scholar by any means. I found this book on the shelf in the kind of very ratty Peace Corps library, like in 1984 or something, and needing something to read, and it looked like a good political thriller, which it kind of really isn't. I loved it because it suddenly kind of crystallized for me at that time. I was a Peace Corps volunteer for about a year. And there really wasn't, I was finding, much literature on West Africa.
And you were a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa?
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, sandwiched right between Ghana and Benin and south of Burkina Faso. It was this part of the world that Updike was really writing about, the fictional country of Kush, which I think a lot of people would assume to be Niger. But The Coup just had all these references to things that I was seeing at the time, and it just kind of like sprang to life, and I was like, John Updike, I thought he wrote those books about that guy Rabbit, and here's this book about, you know, this Colonel Hakim Felix Elilou, who's this kind of semi-humorous but ultimately, I think, kind of corrupt dictator who's kind of wandering, whiling away his time in retirement in southern France. And it all started kind of like being very real, like, okay, so this is happening. There are these despots who retired to the south of France, and, you know, nothing's more real in a strange way than fiction. And it also brought to life this kind of French West African obsession with France, with, you know, the hexagon, as they called France, the colonial power. And so, you know, the kind of way kids grew up in West Africa, and I was teaching, so I was watching this almost obsequious, we are not worthy kind of attitude toward the French. And you go to Ivory Coast and you find Ivoirians who speak French better than the French do. They'll use the passé simple in speech, which is in a way ridiculous because it's this kind of literary form of writing, this tense that you never hear spoken, certainly not today. And the Ivorians were masters of it. And French culture, they, you know, knew where to buy the best baguette in Paris. Or in Senegal, I mean, you know, what's his name? Leopold Sédar Senghor, one of the great patriots in Senegalese history. But a lot of West Africans admire him, not because he was a Senegalese patriot, but because he was the first African admitted to the Académie Française, you know, like the police school of grammar for France. And so I came across this passage in The Coup where all of this seemed to come out. This is sort of in the beginning of the book, and the president of the country, Colonel Hakim Felix Elilou, has a kind of concubine lover on the side named Kutunda, and he comes back to the capital of Kush. It's a place called Istiklal. Evidently, upon his return to Istiklal, Elilou established Kutunda in an apartment above a basket weaving shop whose real dealings were in hashish and khat. Her presence here and his suspicion of a conspiracy whose headquarters were in the capital reinforced his habit of venturing disguised into the city, especially the disreputable section known as Huria, which rises like heaps of mud boxes stacked for removal against the eastern wall of the vast Palais de l'Administration des Noirs. This is this fictional bureaucratic place known as the Palace for the Administration of the Blacks, with its 16 pilasters representing the 16 most common verbs that require être instead of avoir as auxiliary in all compound tenses. Its facade is topped with 8 marble statues of an unreal whiteness, unerroded in this climate, that symbolize the 8 bourgeois virtues: assiduité, économie, médiocrité, conjugalité, tempérance, optimisme, dynamisme, and modernité. Its blank side glows in the dawn like the flank of an eternal voluptuous promise, heaving itself free of the earth, above the little roofs of thatch, cracked tile, and rock-weighted tin. And it's just, you know, it's magnificent Updike, but it's also, you know, taking you to, I mean, can you imagine, like, West Africans thinking about tempérance, you know, temperance and kind of modesty in this way. I mean,
and getting the conjugations right.
And then getting the conjugations right. I mean, I remember being in school and remembering the irregular verbs. There was a mnemonic device, Monsieur and Madame Van Ditton. And Van Ditton was like V for venir, A for aller. You know, all the French verbs that are totally irregular. And this is just like so classic. You know, I think... And I go back to Leopold Senghor. It's like the best thing he's known for probably in West Africa is a children's book he wrote when he was kind of embraced by France. And it's kind of like their version of Dick and Jane. It's called Luc le Lièvre, which is one of the hardest things to pronounce, Luc the rabbit or the hare. And it's the story of this little hare. And like every child in West Africa has read this book in primary school. So John Updike, thank you for making this book, and unfortunately it was your passing that reminded me of it way up there on the 10th shelf in my living room.
The Big Show's Marco Werman. Among other things, Marco's the guy behind most of The Big Show's global hits. And yes, there is a global hit podcast. And for the audio of John Updike, by the way, our thanks go to our colleagues at Wired for Books. That is part of the WOUB Center for Public Media at Ohio University. That's it for today. More linguistic global goodies next week. See you then. Félicité, mwana mwasi suka bodebe. Oya lelo, o bebisi mokili awa. Na mokanzi, kana elenge paraiso. Ami pesi, nyoso sena yo. Félicité, mwana mwasi suka bodebe.